I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is author Paul Rappaport. He's the author of the new book, Gliders Over Hollywood, Airships, Airplay, and the Art of Rock Promotion, which is out April 15th via Jawbone Press. Rappaport worked with a wide range of artists during his time at Columbia Records, including Judas Priest, Pink Floyd, and the Rolling Stones. His book is filled with a number of almost unbelievable stories about promotional strategies for various albums and bands, and you'll get just a glimpse of those in this conversation. We started off talking about one of Columbia Records' more obscure signings, the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood. You would be also interested to know that there was a Columbia signing that came out of Wichita. But I think before your time with the label, it would have been 1970, the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood, Wichita by way of San Francisco.
It wasn't before my time, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because I was a college rep, right? In from 69 to, well, they hired me in 70, but I got a real job in 71. But I think that I was promoting that record in college, the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood, when I was at UCLA. So I'm familiar with the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's great. That's great. Because they were Mike Finnegan, of course, who went on to do all this stuff with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, had come to Kansas from Ohio on a basketball scholarship. And he
Really? Oh, no, I didn't know that. Because he's a tall guy, right?
Yep.
And he worked with Dave Mason a lot, too.
Yep.
He's a guy. I remember talking to him once. Because I got to know all the musicians because I'm a musician. So I wanted to know all them, talk musician stuff, right? So I didn't realize that Finnegan had such a long career. And I found out that he played some very, very big arenas and sort of like rock halls of fame. But to him, they were all joints, like a juke joint. It didn't matter. He'd go, yeah, I played that joint. I'm like, no, Mike, that's like Cobo Hall. That's like, you know, that's huge. That's a Detroit legend. Yeah, I played that joint.
Yep.
And that's where he starts. Oh, okay.
So he had been up at University of Kansas, and he was too busy going to clubs at night playing, and he got booted from the team. So he found his way to Wichita, which is where he met his wife, Candy. And he was in a couple bands around here and then made his way to San Francisco where he reconnected with Jerry Hahn. That's how you get the Jerry Hahn Brotherhood.
He was a good guy, Finnegan. It was somebody, Finnegan and Kruger. Mason? What's Dave Mason? Mason, Finnegan, and Kruger, I think. Yep. Because there was that song. Oh, I got to think of that song. It's a beautiful song about splitting up, a divorce. What's the name of that song? Yeah, We Just Disagree.
Yeah.
I got to write that down. Do you know that song?
Oh, yeah.
There ain't no good guys. There ain't no bad guys. And that was a record that they put out, and that was Finnegan played on it. That was their band. They thought they might go out as a power sort of trio. Did okay. Just, you know, didn't do great. But that's where I got to know Finnegan. He's just a cool guy.
I want to start at the beginning, which starts with the taping of this Bruce Springsteen show. And it was this reminder, I guess, that there was this time where Bruce Springsteen couldn't just walk into a city and own it.
You know, people need to understand that all of these artists, especially artists that are cutting their own groove, and it doesn't matter if you're Bruce Springsteen or Billy Joel or Aerosmith, doesn't matter. It's a new sound. People have to get into it. You know, the industry, you know, the radio people have to like it. The press people have to like it. These are the gatekeepers at that time that you have to get through to get to the public. But it doesn't matter if you're Bruce Springsteen, even the Beatles and the Stones. I mean, these guys played clubs forever. I didn't even realize the Rolling Stones had come to America and played clubs before I saw them. I didn't know they had. You know, information's different then. There's no internet. You get information on the radio or word of mouth or whatever. By the time I saw the Rolling Stones at the Hollywood Bowl, they might have done two tours in states I didn't even know about that played clubs. By the time I saw Jimi Hendrix, he was doing college shows. He played my college. I didn't even know about it. Jimi Hendrix played UCLA, and afterwards, some friends of mine said, "Hey, Rap Man, you're gonna want to know about this guy." I'm like, yeah, what's Jimi Hendrix? I go, yeah. They go, you really want to know about this guy. And so I went and got Are You Experienced and got experienced, right? And went, oh my God. So it's like that for anybody. So yes, during that time at the Roxy, we're still trying to get him recognized because this is before any hit singles that he has. Once you have a hit single, now you're reading another broad-based pop audience, right? Once you have a hit single, you got a whole slew of fans that didn't even know about you, but they love your record, right? So they love Hungry Heart. Back then, no. We used to joke that Bruce had the biggest cult following because we could sell 1 million records from album rock radio, but that's it. So we, it's, yeah, Bruce has got a cult following of 1 million people, which, by the way, so did Bob Dylan. He, no matter what, we could only sell 1 million records, so he couldn't. That's all another story. He couldn't understand that. But no, so the Roxy show, the reason we did the Roxy show was because we hadn't really taken Los Angeles by storm, which is difficult to do. LA is a big town. There's a lot going on. It's hard to get people to pay attention. So even though Bruce is playing the Forum, which is the big arena, it's a sellout, it was kind of a quiet show because at that time he's big enough to sell out the Forum. I don't know how many seats it was at the time, 12,000 maybe, maybe more, maybe 15,000. I don't know, but he could sell that out. So the tickets go on sale and it sells out. You don't hear about it on the radio. It's not like, oh, get your tickets to Bruce Springsteen, because it just sells out. So it's called what we call a quiet show. The act comes, he plays, it's great. The people that see him love it. It goes away. No one doesn't do anything. Doesn't move the needle. John Lando called and said, look, we're not moving the needle. We need to do something. And he suggested, can we do a live broadcast on the big rock station at the time, KMET? And I said, sure. And the only thing that was shocking is when I asked him, I said, when do you want to do it? And he goes, this Friday. And I was like, are you kidding me? So like, it takes 2 weeks minimum to set these up. So, it was like hell on wheels putting it together, which you read about in the book. And then it almost didn't happen, which you read about in the book, because it was insane backstage and the general manager was drunk and out of his mind and it's pandemonium. And to this day, well, Landau knows because I sent him the text. He goes, I got to send this to Bruce. He doesn't even know. I go, I know. Both you guys don't know. I said, I never told you, right? Like, because why would I? All they needed to know was that it happened, that the show went on. And then all they needed, and the big secret, of course, which, I've revealed in the book, for the first time, is that the rebroadcast of that show isn't the original show, because the original show, as I wrote in the book, is the original broadcast, as you read, had a lot of extra disc jockey speak in it because the general manager at the time was completely out of his mind. He changed the host at the last minute. The guy who did it had to read a script that he made him read. And when you do live broadcasts, you just let them run. You let the music run. Maybe if it's running over an hour or so, you'll break in between a song and go, hi, blah, blah, you're listening to KMET. This is Bruce Springsteen live at the Roxy. That's it. But the general manager wanted all this junk, like, oh, he rocked you at, he rocked you in New York, he rocked you, and now he's rocking you at the Roxy. It was horrible. They got away with it on the first broadcast because nobody's hearing that. Bruce Springsteen in 1978 in L.A. is becoming a he's got such a gaggle of fans. He's on his way to becoming a superstar, and so this broadcast is like. KMET had a seven share. I mean, that's all Los Angeles is listening to. The Sunset Strip is packed full of cars. Their windows are rolled down. The radio's on. People are listening to Bruce live at the Roxy. There's kids dancing in the streets. It's like nuts, right? So they got away with it the first time because no one's paying attention, right? But I didn't want people to hear that again. I want people to hear seamless music. And you'll hear some jock speak, but I didn't want them to hear all this junk that, as far as I'm concerned, is gonna mess it up. So, as you read, like at 3 in the morning, after I had a nice meeting with Bruce, which was very personal and meant a lot to me, I went to the engineer of the station and I said, gosh, man, we gotta edit this. We can't, you're gonna want to rebroadcast this tonight and it can't air again like this. I gotta give tapes to John Landau and Bruce Springsteen. And in those days you could pass tapes around to people in the industry, and I knew the bootleg would come from one of these cassettes or whatever that I had. And I said, we can't have this. No one, this can't happen, right? So we went back to the studio at 4 in the morning for 2 hours and edited this show, all the junk, like the tapes dropping to the floor of KMET. And now it's running like it should run, seamless, just music, 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 Bruce stories, da 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 da. And you'll hear Bob in there a little bit, but even a point where he was talking over Max's drums, you know, Gus was an amazing engineer and he was able to splice that and no one would ever know. And no one knows to this day. And they won't know until they read the book, like the bootleg they have. It's not what they think. The bootleg they have, it's the title of the prologue. The bootleg you have isn't what you think it is, because it isn't. Landau was so excited. He goes, Bruce is going to love this. I go, well, send it to him, you know? So yeah, no, and then that blew LA to pieces. I mean, that broadcast was so big that I went to a Friday night dinner. I'm Jewish, so it was Friday night dinner is the thing, right? And I go to Sharon, my wife Sharon's grandmother's house for dinner. And her cousin, maybe the guy's like 14 at the time, he's younger than me. He's like maybe he's 14 or 15 at the time. We're at the table and he knows I'm in music. He doesn't know exactly what I do, but he knows I'm in music. And he goes, hey, Paul, did you hear about that Bruce Springsteen podcast? It got to Mitchell, right? Got to Mitchell Moore. I was like, yeah, I heard about it.
Well, I had a question about that, at the label, because I looked at the sale. I actually looked at the sales figures for Springsteen's records before Born in the USA, and it would be like a million. He'd get a top 10 album and stuff. But I have the sense that before 1984, it was kind of a record to record thing in terms of him like building as an act, right? It wasn't necessarily like a done deal that he was going to be this superstar.
Nope. He becomes a, well, he becomes a superstar when he has his first hit, Hungry Heart, from the river. And then when Born in the USA comes out, he's just explodes into this gargantuan thing. And it was just, it's building like the way that it should from the ground up, little by little, by little, by little, by little. He's getting better and better and better. The live shows were always great, but now he's playing big arenas and he's learning how to do that. Yeah, that's when it just kind of goes nuts, in those years. No, all those records leading up are just the building process. And that's normal for how things were. And so you could never count on anything. You listen and go, okay, what tracks do we have? All of this is going to be on rock radio. The idea in the 80s was, and probably in the late 70s, because FM radio became so big on its own, the idea was that like my department would launch music on FM airwaves, and then the top 40 department would cross over a record to top 40, and that's when things would explode. It was that way with Bruce. It was that way with Journey. It was that way with Psychedelic Furs, Men at Work. When I start in the rock department, by then I mean the Stones are already the Stones. The Pink Floyd's already Pink Floyd. But look, I mean Pink Floyd doesn't have a lot of hit songs. I mean they have some, but they don't make hit singles, right? So like The Wall was huge because it had those hits, right? But all bands like that, it's boots to the ground and you keep working. It's you keep working. The band keeps working. Bruce keeps. I mean, look, the Roxy Show, and I wrote this in the story. What was very touching. After the show, I've been up for 3 nights and 3 days putting this thing together. I am paced. I'm just sitting in a chair in the Roxy bar overlooking the Sunset Strip. It's empty, and I'm just gone. He walks in. Now, you should get up. It's Bruce Springsteen. You should get up. I can't get up by the chair, and I really don't care. Like, I know that we did something really good. And I know that I played a big part in putting something together that's going to matter. And Bruce played his part being the artist. And I just looked up at him because I literally couldn't get out of the chair. And I was just, hey, how you doing? He could see. He looked at me and goes, man, you are toast. I go, yes. It's been a lot, 3 days and 3 nights. So he kneels down. And he says, "Rap." He goes, All these people told me everything you did, like how hard you worked, like how impossible this all was. He said, "I can't thank you enough." Takes my left hand in his hand, kisses my hand. I'm not used to being kissed by guys. My dad, yeah. I'm not used to being kissed by a budding superstar, Bruce Springsteen, to say the least. But it wasn't like that. It was like from a guy to a guy, right? It wasn't like, oh, I'm the rock star. It wasn't like that at all. It was a guy to a guy, but he looked at me and he goes, "I want to thank you," because he said, "You have no idea how hard I'm trying to make this happen." Now, this is already in 1978. You ask our thing, are we still working hard? You have no idea how hard I'm working to make this happen. And I have never seen a harder working artist than Bruce Springsteen. Maybe Tony Bennett's a second. People don't know his work ethic, but off the charts, professional. Springsteen, out of control. I never seen anything like it close to Bruce Springsteen. His early days, even playing big arenas. So Bruce has a wire that's about 100 feet long. So you go to Madison Square Garden. The band is rehearsing on stage. Bruce is plugged into his amp, but the wire's going all the way down the center aisle to the soundboard, where Bruce is not only rehearsing the band, playing guitar, he's twisting the knobs himself with his sound guy to get the sound that he wants. Okay, who does this? But he's the most intense guy I've ever met in my life. I mean, this guy is the most intense person I've ever met in my life. And he's doing this, rehearsing the band for sound check for Bruce Springsteen band, typical 2 hours. Most band sound checks 20 minutes, half an hour. E Street Band, 2 hours. I went to one that was 3 hours. But when you see them play and you see Bruce perform, you get religion, because all that work is designed for your mind to be blown and for you to leave with a big smile on your face for a month. They know what they're doing. They're doing it on purpose, but I never seen a guy work like that. And then after the show, want to meet people? Never a rushed conversation. Be a line of people backstage. Who are you? What do? You had to wait to talk to him because he's not going to rush you, right? Talk to everybody. Finally, go back to the hotel, maybe at 1:30 in the morning, go to sleep. Get up the next day and do the whole thing all over again. Hardest working man in show business. It's unbelievable. And that's why he's still, who he is today. And he's still working that hard. So God bless him.
I am not being ironic when I say this, but I have to say that now I'm not a Christian. I was raised Catholic, but I don't go around proclaiming myself a Christian. But Bob Dylan's Christian era is to me some of his best work. And it is to me that way because it's like, oh yeah, in case you forgot, this is a guy who's an artist and this is his conviction.
Well, no, yes, that is his conviction. The one thing that you can always get from Bob, thank God, anything he ever does, whether it resonates with a lot of people or a few people, it's authentic. Okay? This Bob doesn't do anything other than authentic. He could have done things that might have propelled his career this way or that way, but he doesn't think that way. Right? I'm writing in my book where I'm backstage with him and Eric Clapton, and Nick Clapton's going, "Hey, we got to make a record together." And I'm like, "Oh my God, this will be amazing." And Bob's blowing him off, right? And I'm thinking to myself, "Bob, do not blow off Eric Clapton. Like, that's a mistake." I can't say it because I'm in the back of the trailer. They don't even know that I'm there, but I'm watching this go down. I'm like, "Oh my God." But Bob's not that guy. He's not. "Oh yeah, this will be cool. Like, I do a record with Eric." It's don't think like that. He told Eric in a polite way, "Look, I'm really maybe one day, but I'm just doing my own thing right now." Right? And he always does. But I think that it is authentic. What I find at the time, I think I felt different, but what I learned later in life, which was amazing, is I went to church. I can't remember if somebody was getting married, but I went to church. I hadn't been to church in a long time, but I'm watching the priest, and I'm like, "Well, this looks really familiar." He's got like a cap on his head, which, I'm Jewish, so cantor and around, he's wearing vestments. He's got like a tallit, right? He's holding wine. I'm like, "Well, hey, wait a minute. But here's the thing. Okay, I'm a pretty spiritual person. Okay. This guy was the most amazing priest. And I don't, I forgive me, I don't know what, I don't know if I was in Catholic Church or, whatever it was. He said, I want everybody here to understand that we're all human beings together, and I want everyone to hold the hand next to the person next to you, right? This is one of the most beautiful things I've ever been a part of. I have a divine moment in church, okay? I'm Jewish. I am having a divine moment in church. I am connecting with the man above. I'm thinking, well, this is amazing. What does that tell me? We all have different religions, but maybe it all connects to the same universe, right? Fast forward, my synagogue's having an evening with many different religions and priests and pastors and rabbis and Hindu, to discuss religion, right? How does this all work, right? I raise my hand to tell this story, and all of them freak. All of them. That can't be possible. I go, no, it's possible. The Jewish people, they're like, no, that can't happen. I'm like, it did happen. And the priests even, they're like, no, that can't, no one could. These are the professional people that we go to for faith. They could not handle that I had, divine moment in a church. Couldn't handle it. Afterwards, we're having cake and cookies. The priest's wife comes over and whispers in my ear, I don't care what my husband said. I think like you do. I'm not surprised at that moment in my life that that I understood that later when Bob got into it, I was more curious. It didn't bother me, but my job was to focus radio on playing his music and don't get hung up on whatever Bob's exploring. That's his exploration. But people are people, and it's, oh my God, what's happening? It's like, I don't know what's happening, but the music's good, right? It's like, I don't care what's happening. The music is good, right? Let's trust the music. Play the music. I don't, Bob might be a Hindu 2 months from now. I don't know, and I don't care. Right. And I don't even know, Bob's a mercurial kind of guy. Later, he was quoted as saying that he doesn't even believe in any organized religion and he gets his religious beliefs from music. So you never know what Bob Dylan's thinking at any moment in his life. But to your point, all of that music is good. But I will be honest with you, I had to spoon feed it to radio little by little because they were freaked out. And I sent them the saved record, in a white sleeve, so they could hear the music before they saw the finger of Jesus, because that would have just, when you do promotion, you need to, you get to prepare people before they hear music, right? You get to help form their opinion. The last thing you want to do ever, even if it's not controversial, is just play somebody music and go, what's your opinion? That's the worst thing you can do. Like, you'd never do that. Not that you don't, have any respect for these people, but you want to guide them. You want them to give the opinion you want. That's an art form. There is a way to talk to people. There is a way to set them up. There is a way, if you, I don't know how much you got to read in the book, but I delved into certain chapters on just the psychology of a human being, because my job was to open your mind for new music, not just the hits, but the lifeblood of a record company is new music. So all of this new music, you have to open someone's mind. You have to put them in the right frame of mind to listen to the music. So when they listen to it, they're in a happy mood. They're like, oh, wow, this is pretty good. Because as programmers, they're trying to keep their ratings. And so anything they know that's proven is great. Anything new scares them. So it was the same for Bob, for, well, Slow Train was the beginning. Then, you've got Shot Saved, Shot of Love, those records. Music's great. Bob went on tour with Gospel Gals. It was a thing. It was a different show. It was almost like a gospel show. Now, here's what people need to know about Bob Dylan. If you go to a Bob Dylan show and you think, or you have an expectation that you want Bob to be a jukebox and play his 60s hits for you, that's not what he's doing. Bob is like Picasso. Every night, Bob's painting a different picture. You want to go see Picasso paint? Go see Bob Dylan. Because one night, he may have gospel singers. One of the greatest gospel songs ever written is written by Bob Dylan. I heard it on the radio, and I don't even know the name of the song, but it's about a black mother who loses a child, right? And I think, I can't remember, I don't want to say it wrong. I don't know if it's at a time in the Civil War, but it's a black experience. And I'm thinking, wow, this is a great song. This must be, you know, one of those songs that's an old folk song that no one knows who wrote it, but it's traditional, whatever. I loved it so much, I looked it up. Who wrote it? Bob freaking Dylan. It's like, what? So you want to go watch Picasso paint even today? Go see Bob Dylan. Don't go with expectations, and just be there for the experience. Because he's always changing. It depends what he feels like. I mean, his band will tell you in the middle, the shows are different. The whole show could be, what's the set list? Well, here it is for now, but it could change 10 minutes from now. And he'll just turn around and go, okay, now we're doing this. And they have to know that song. And they have to know the changes. Well, how's this? Oh, we're going to do this, but let's do it in G. Oh, okay. You got to be a really good musician to keep up with Bob Dylan, right? So that's how he is. Yeah, and the music was great, and I had to spoon feed it to radio so that they would understand. Let's not get hung up on Bob's beliefs. You know, they're going to change back and forth, and just please play music that's good music. And we did. We were successful.
I want to talk about Blue Oyster Cult. They have this like through line. There's a concept there that Sandy Pearlman's kind of put in place. And they've got the great album covers, but there's mystery. And there's a sense of humor, but there's also a sense of foreboding with them, you know? So they've got this great package.
I'm curious. Do you know about Sandy Pearlman just from my book, or are you aware of this band and their career and Sandy from, from?
Yeah, deep history. I grew up with an older brother with a copy of On Your Feet or On Your Knees that was always on the turntable.
One of my biggest thrill, like for us, one of the greatest records of all time. To this day, if you like blue, even if you do, you like rock, just go out and get On Your Feet or On Your Knees, and you can get it streaming. One of my biggest thrills was on the back of that album cover, there was a Bible, right? And these were the people that had helped this band get to where they got, and my name's in the Bible. Well, I was like, I could retire now. My name's in the Blue Oyster Cult Bible. I'm done. But that's, talk about a band cutting their own groove. And you have a lot of songwriters, Sandy being one of them. Again, it's all authentic. Nobody's thinking, well, let's write this, it'll freak people out. It doesn't work that way. The songs come from up there into here, and then they're crafted by Buck Dharma and the rest of the band. Everybody believes different about life. Just my two cents, just for me, I think a lot of things are written. That's just who I am. I don't think any of this stuff happens by accident. I've come to believe that Blue Oyster Cult's making their music. I'm sitting in the chair I'm sitting in when I'm supposed to be sitting in it. Not only for them. And I would never say ever that without me, none of these bands would happen. You can't say that. They would happen different. They would happen maybe not as fast. I'll never, I can't, nobody should make that claim. Well, if it wasn't for me, but I do know that I was making a huge difference at certain times with certain bands. And I would look at this and I'd go, is this like meant to happen? Like I know for sure, like Alice in Chains, if you read a story about Alice in Chains, I guarantee you that doesn't happen without someone like me who understands that music and just goes on a mission to just make it happen no matter what. And I had a few of those along the way. Sometimes you're just a bigger cog in a bigger, like the wheel is turning and you play your part, and I think I play my part like in Journey and those kind of things. And I certainly played a big role in helping Pink Floyd reach a wider audience and things I did for the Rolling Stones, but I'm a part of a bigger thing. But sometimes you're the guy that leads the charge. And so with Blue Oyster Cult, I was that guy. Okay, so you're a kid listening to your brother's records, right? Okay, I'm sitting in my office in Los Angeles in Hollywood, Columbia would release a lot of albums, and not all of them came with a plan, with a marketing plan or a priority, or somebody saying, "Hey, whatever you do, promote whatever you want, but make sure this and this and this happens." Hey, it's 10 years after, man. Got to make sure that happened. Well, who wouldn't? Come on, it's like Alvin Lee. This record shows up with nothing, just that album cover, that MC Escher. It looks scary, that album cover with all the doors. First of all, if you look at the cover and then the name says Blue Oyster Cult, if you're a child of the 60s, that's me, right? You've gone through the marijuana psychedelics and you look at that album cover, the first thing you think of is like, who are these guys, right? And then you read the album, the song title, Cities on Flame with Rock and Roll, Transmaniacon MC. I mean, like, so I put the needle down, and it's amazing. It's everything you said it was. It's rock, but it's mysterious. It's unique. Blue Oyster Cult's rock, but it's almost like a bebop style. It's not like Black Sabbath metal. It's different. I fell in love with it. I called New York. This guy Murray Krugman was the product manager at the time for the band. He also became their co-manager. I'm like, who are these guys? He goes, you like this? I'm like, oh my, this is amazing. Well, he was happy because, that's an acquired taste, right? So not everybody at Columbia is listening to the Blue Oyster Cult going, oh my God, it's the next big thing. It's just, some surfer dude that's in the record business now running local promotion in LA thinks this is the greatest thing since sliced toast. So he's got a live one. He goes, okay, look, I'm going to, so I took the record. I took it to a station in Long Beach, California, which is just outside of Los Angeles. And they played more new music because they could. They're not under the pressure of the big ratings. So I used to start a lot of records on KNAC. Took it down to this guy, Ron McCoy from Texas, first Texan I ever met. Was just a great, great experience, just even meeting a Texan, right? He had boots with the silver tips, and he was into ZZ Top, and I was getting into ZZ Top, and it was like this great thing. He loves the record. He starts playing the record. Then Murray says, "I'm going to send you something better. I'm going to send you a live. We've got four songs live, and you'll really hear the band with how they really are." And we had the bootleg EP. When I heard that, I was like, "Oh my God, this is off the charts." I mean, this first of all, Buck Darman's a guitar god. Eric Bloom's a badass front man. The rhythm section, Joe and Albert Bouchard. I mean, this is unbelievable. I give that to Ron. He starts playing the heck out of that. Next thing you know, we're selling records. Then I put together the big concert for them, at the Long Beach Arena with KNAC, did another big show, you read about in the book, in San Diego. Between all that airplay and those two concerts, that exploded their career. And it reverberated across the country, and we've been—I mean, I've been friends with those guys ever since. So I'm looking for quotes. Obviously, we want people to be excited. I got a wonderful quote from Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. I got a great quote from Elvis Costello. You want to talk about a guy? I don't think I've seen Elvis in 20 years. Hey, you want me to send you what I wrote? A day later, I get a quote. No, boom. Okay, Elvis Costello is a guy. Okay, this guy's got a big heart. Okay, now get this. Last minute, I get something from Buck from Blue Oyster Cult. The quote that was supposed to be on the back of this is from the manager of Joan Baez and Graham Nash, who had a wonderful quote. And I have yet to tell him that his quote got bumped off the. I don't know how to tell him, but they like this one better. So, okay, this is, you talked about something that matters to me. Okay, this is from Buck Darma, Blue Oyster Cult, lead guitar player from Blue Oyster Cult. It took an essential symbiosis of artists, record companies, and radio to make the musical memories we all hold dear. Without Paul's personal creativity, energy, and enthusiasm, the Blue Oyster Cult would never have reached the audience and endurance it has. It's the same for every artist he connected with. Thanks, Donald. But that's these guys. That's who they are. I mean, they're good people. But I was a big part in the beginning. So I'm working in LA. Then I go to New York, and now I'm the guy, right? I'm the head of the rock department, and I can do bigger things because now I'm running the whole show. So Then you find me shooting laser beams off mountainsides and stuff like that. What's that? That freaked a lot of people out, man. Woohoo! So, but again, anything I could do big that says, look here, but they're wonderful guys. Their most recent albums are they put out two records. There's a most recent one I haven't heard yet, but the one before, which was a couple of years ago, it's one of their best records ever. They went in the studio on a mission to make a great record. I live ne near Eric Bloom. The reason I live where I live is because of him. Because I just he kept inviting us out for barbecues into Port Washington, and I went with Sharon. I was like, well, this reminds me of California. Let's move here. But when he put out the record a couple of years ago, I went over to his house, sat in his car, and listened to the album with him. He's older now, right? But if you listen to the album, his voice sounds like 1975. And I'm like, how did you do that? And he told me the truth. He goes line by line to make it as great as it could be, or a few lines in a row, but not a whole song in a row. Doesn't matter. I mean, that's how records are recorded anyway. They take comp vocals from, guitar players. They comp. People think all these guitar parts were played all in a row. Well, they weren't. They were played on five different tracks, and they took this part from here and splice it up, and voila, right? Especially with the newer guys, the older guys, not so much. Eric Clapton's records, nope, they're not comped. They are. I had a wonderful talk with Ted Templeman about From the Cradle, one of my favorite Eric Clapton. I said, Ted, these solos are so amazing. Are they comped? He goes, nope. He would just play one, tell me he could do it better, play it again. I had one that I thought was the greatest one I've ever heard, and he goes, nah, come back tomorrow, I'll do it better. So this guy's like, he's the real deal, so he can do that. Donald can do that. Buck Darvin is one of the, he's an unsung hero, guitar hero, because he's always in this package of Blue Oyster Cult, right? He doesn't play with other bands. If you know Blue Oyster Cult, you know Buck Darvin, but if you don't, you don't. But if you go see the Blue Oyster Cult to this day and you watch him play, you'll lose your mind. Like, watch this guy play guitar. And I knew him when he was only playing with four fingers. One tour, he comes back, because I like talking guitar with all these guys, right? So he comes back and he goes, look at this. And now he's using his pinky and he can do more. He goes, look at that. I'm like, whoa. Because most of these blues guys are four finger, well, three finger guitar. Really, it's just these three that you use. Well, you use your pinky when you're playing rock and roll, but you don't use it for a note. Today's guitar players do because they learn on YouTube and everybody's, learning how to type per se. But most of Clapton doesn't. Most of the blues guys are all Keith Richards. It's all three fingers. But Donald comes back because he's playing his kind of stuff is more notes. Going, look what I can do. Da-da-ding, da-da-ding. And I'm going, oh my God, how are you doing that? He's like, just showing me. Like, so anyway.
I love too, there's a moment, I think you're describing how Judas Priest, how those guys were like so normal and kind. And I think you mentioned Eric Bloom. You're like, it's like it's one of those things where it's like he's on the phone with his wife talking about the kids going to Hebrew school, and it just doesn't.
You can't put the it's hard. Look, I'm a professional music industry person, but I'm still a fan because that's what got us, all the music people that I worked with in our time, we're all fans. I mean, that's why we got in the business, the music. I didn't even care about the perks. The perks were fun, but I was there for the music. It's just, here's music. I love it. It's natural for me to tell the world about it. That's what I got to do. Hey, you need to know about this band called Midnight Oil, right? Like, that's what I was about. So when you get to bands that have a persona, you never know an artist's personality till you meet them. But when you get to sort of the glam rock, the Ian Hunters, or the heavy metal, where now there's a persona on stage. The first time I saw Judas Priest was at the Whiskey a Go-Go, scared the hell out of me. I was like, God, how am I going to even talk to these guys? They look like if I don't even know if I should be in a like. Can I go in a rest dressing room with them? Are they going to beat me up? Rob Halford, man, he looked mean, right? And they turned out to be just the sweetest people. Blue Oyster Cult, same thing. On stage, you got the spikes, you got the laser ring, you got all this stuff, the songs. And backstage, this is the music they like to play, but they don't go to the store to get, milk and bread and their spikes and leather. They like that's for the stage, right? So, but you don't know that till you meet them. So I always loved hanging out with them because they're just great guys. And again, I'm a player, so I can talk to KK and Glenn about what guitars do they play and what do they like, how are they learning these solos. And Rob Halford is one of the most beautiful people I've ever met. I mean, he didn't never took himself too seriously. I once took him for an interview, and on the way, he looked at me and he said, "Rah." Until his voice opens up, right? It's very raspy. I always have to get him tea because it's hard on his vocals. He nudged me. He goes, "Rap." I go, "What?" He goes, "You know, I'm a rock god, right?" Like, and he's having a laugh, right? I mean, and he is to fans, but come on, right? He's like, even all these guys, Jerry Garcia, hated it. Hated the God thing. Hated the Jerry Garcia. Like it was too much. It was like, he couldn't handle it. Bob Dylan, oh my God, like, he look what happened to that poor guy. People hounding him, thinking he knew the answer to their life story, whatever. So, so I always appreciated artists who were proud of what they did, but didn't take themselves that seriously, and Judas Priest, a hardworking band, some of the greatest music you'll ever hear, melodic, so you can sing the songs. And I wrote in my book, when we finally reached a platinum status, which was a big goal for us, for me and for the band, before the Screaming for Vengeance album and before it came out, they said, "God, we really want a platinum record. All we can get is a gold record." I go, "No, man, I'm your guy. I love this band so much." But they had to make the record to do it. Like, I can't just magically. I magically made a gold record, but that's another story that you read about in the book. But generally, that can't happen, right? That's the magic trick. But generally, the music has to be there. And with Screaming for Vengeance, they had it all. I said, "Okay, here's the plan. We're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and this single will do this, and maybe it'll reach top 40." And they said, "Well, look, if you get us a platinum record, we're going to buy you a motorcycle jacket, just like the one Rob has." And I was like, "Well, I appreciate it. I love it. I don't need a present. If you're of that mind, I'm really not a motorcycle jacket guy, but I've always wanted a bomber jacket, like from World War II. If you're ever around, if it's still in your mind, I would accept that, but I don't need it. I'm not expecting anything." So we're just talking. That's it. It's just a conversation. There's a whole tour through three tracks and a hit single later. Springtime comes and a box shows up in my office. From nowhere. It's a mysterious box. There's nothing on it. It's just a box with my name on it. Open the box. Here's a note. "To Rap, we can't thank you enough. Cheers, Judas Priest." Take off the out of the paper and what is under it? "The most beautiful brown leather bomber jacket you could ever want." Who does that? Who thinks like that? Who would remember that? These guys are busy. They're touring. Right? Who would remember that all those months later? Okay, you want to know who Judas Priest is? That's who they are. So, come on. I mean, those guys are guys. They're like salt of the earth. Probably because, they came from, like a tough place. I mean, Glenn Tipton told me, man, I'm from like Birmingham, man. It's like working class in a factory. I'm trying to get out of there. He got into Judas. He told me, when he was Judas Priest, "I'm trying this. I hope this works." In the very early years of Judas Priest, right? "I'm trying this. I hope this works." He's still learning how to play guitar, by the way. And then he became an amazing guitar player. Both him and KK, right? Just come on. Hey, anybody out there that wants to shred, there's the old school, the new school, and there's the school. You want the school? Go listen to Judas Priest. Those guys rip it. Wonderful people. I worked with Rob later in life. Every time I worked with him, nothing but the best. Just beautiful human being. And he deserves everything great that happens, for him. Are they in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I don't even know.
Yeah, they are now. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Because there's a whole lot of people that aren't that should be. But if they are, then God bless them because they should be. I still listen to their music in the car. I mean, I'm just a big kid. I mean, I don't even realize how old I am. I'm in the car, it's crank everything to 11, right? Screaming for Vengeance comes on. I'm like singing, mind playing air guitar. It's like, I don't think that's ever going to change. I was once putting my younger son to sleep, Sam, and he was giving me a hard time. And I just wouldn't go to sleep. And he just, why do I have to go to sleep now? I said, because I'm the grown up and I'm telling you, you got to go to sleep. And maybe Sam's 8 or whatever. He looks up at me and he goes, Dad, you're not grown up. I was like, no, I'm the grown up. You're the kid. He goes, you're not grown up. You're just a big kid. I go, well, when do you think I'm going to grow up? He goes, you? This is an 8-year-old talking to me. He goes, you? I don't know. I mean, like 90 or 100. I was like, Sam, I love you. I give him the biggest hug and the kiss. I go, go to sleep whenever you want. I don't care. I walk out the now I have granddaughters who think I'm a cartoon character, so I'm having a good time.
Well, listen, we've been going at this. So I want to be respectful of your time, but I want to say this about the book, and based on what we've been talking about, I think this era in which you came up and thrived is one that we don't really see anymore. It was this time where one person, I mean, I think about that story about the DJ Donna Halpert and Rush, and how she broke them, right? Just being a DJ who was playing this record by this Canadian band.
Oh, it happens often. It happened often.
Well,
Loverboy starts because of Gloria Johnson. There's a disc jockey in KGON Portland, Oregon, calling me, going, I'm playing a track and it's the phones are lighting up. You have a hit record. There's a guy, Paul Wells, his nickname's The Lobster, KSJO. Okay, San Jose, Roxanne, The Police. That's Paul Wells. One guy, right? One guy. That's all you need. Starts a match. Right? Yes, that was an era. That is not an anomaly. Rush. It all starts with somebody has to believe in a record. Ron McCoy, KNC, Blue Oyster Cult, Midnight Oil, Beds Are Burning. Okay, that's not a track that you would think would fly on rock radio. It's a different sound. There's a radio station in Cincinnati, WEBN, the tightest radio station in the world. Could never get a new record on EBN, ever. And every so often we'd go, maybe we should just like talk to those guys anymore. So they're not doing anything for us. Well, why are we giving tickets to give away? We would contemplate going out of business with them. So just go away and leave us alone. Out of nowhere, they decide to play Beds Are Burning by Midnight Oil, right? Go figure. Not one of the hip stations, nobody. EBN. And the phones go bananas. And that's the beginning of Midnight Oil success in the United States because one person, one radio station, Alice in Chains, DC 101, same thing. Nobody wants to play Alice in Chains. Nobody can even understand what the music is. They don't get it. One guy, one DJ, not even the PD, a guy on his own, run at the night show, gets Man in the Box and plays it, and the phone lines melt like they've never seen before. They've seen phone lights, they never seen anything like this before. PD calls me the next day. I don't know what this is. I don't understand this music. He goes, this guy played Man in the Box. You don't understand. Like the phones won't stop blinking. Like the kids are calling, this morning, they want to hear it. So to your point, that it was a magic, well, first of all, it was a magic time for so many reasons, but it was a freewheeling business that we made up as we went along. And that was a big part of it, right? It can happen for anything. It's not just us saying this is our priority. Scott Muni and a WNEW in New York. Oh man, I've got this new record, Psychedelic Furs, check it out. Nobody wanted to play Psychedelic Furs, just their name's weird, the music. One guy, I think Sky played it too, Sky Daniels at the Loop in Chicago. Two guys in the whole United States. That's all it took. To build a record. So it was a magical time and a freewheeling time. And it was a time when things could happen and you could make things happen. And the record company gave you money to make things happen. Like they wanted you to go out on your own. Sure, here's the priorities. But if you can make anything happen, our whole MO is just to break new bands all the time. That's the lifeblood of a record company. So if I call New York and go, hey, I just saw this Argon Laser Cannon. You can shoot it off a mountainside. It goes for 30 miles. You know, I want to rent it, right? And they knew me at that. They were like, of course you do. they knew me by that time. But they encouraged it. You know, oh, you want $4,000 to shoot a laser across the Los Angeles skyline? Yes, it will freak a lot of people out. I guarantee you will get noticed, right? People in the know, they'll love it. There'll be a light show for the Reaper, Blue Oyster Cult. People who don't know, they are going to freak out, right? Because they're going to think aliens have landed. But it was that kind of time. And that's what made it glorious. It was like, oh, you can do this? Go do that. You want to do this? Go do that. There was a record, radio convention. I can't remember if it was Abrams. I think it was a Pollock convention or Abrams convention. Everybody was at the Universal Studios for this convention. And Universal at the time had a Star Trek event. You could go in and they'd put you in a Star Trek movie. There was a sound stage and they dressed you up in Star, like you were dressed up in real outfits, Klingon, Star Trek people. They had the stage set. And what they did is it was a fun, funny script, and you reread your parts, and then they interspersed you with real Star Trek. And at the end, at the time, you got a VHS. So you're in Star Trek. You're like Spock's talking, and then they show you, right? Okay, my boss, the head of promotion at Columbia, gave me a lot of money to rent that whole event to put all of rock radio in a Star Trek movie. So everybody came down, we had a big lunch. It's hysterical because, you know, there's the guy running KLOS, he's their head Klingon, Los Angeles, you know, here's Doug who runs Detroit radio. He's playing this guy, I'm Captain Kirk, and we're all, you know, there were some people with alien beings, they had like fake heads with, you know, big, you know, veins. I mean, it was hysterical. You know, this is promotion in motion. I said, okay, you guys, come to my suite tonight and I'll give you your movie. Take it home, show your family. All right. All these people, men and women, they go home. They are the stars of the neighborhood because they're in a Star Trek movie. Okay. This is a business of favors. Okay. I'm breaking a new bands all the time, right? Next week I'm calling up. They go, wow, you know, we know we owe you. We know you owe you one. What are you working on? Right. And I told them a record that nobody really wanted to play, which was Warrant. They a lot of people thought Warrant was a pop band, and they eventually popped out. I was wrong. I thought they were going to be a rock band, but the first record's rocky enough. But they wanted to wait on that. They were going, no, I think these guys are going to pop out. I don't think radio guys knew better than me, but I went, no, I think they're a rock band. Anyway, that's how Warrant had its first hit on rock radio. Not because anybody really wanted to play it, because I guilted people into it because they were in this Star Trek movie. And to a person, and I don't mean to diss Warrant because they're great guys, right? It's just how things are, right? They were pop-esque, and the rock people who are playing Van Halen, it's a stretch for them, but they're going to do me a favor because I'm their guy and we're bonded. And that's how Warrant's first album broke. I think it sold 1 million records because I guilted people into playing it because they were in a Star Trek movie. So, you know, it's promotion in motion, man. But imagine, you're going to your boss, like, you know, I need, you know, I don't know, what did it cost to, I don't even know what it cost to rent the event. It's thousands. Like, they have to stop Universal. We're going to take it over for half a day, you know? So it was fun because you could move and you could do things and you could be creative and people wanted you to be creative. We were assets to our record company. They wanted us to stay there forever, right? That was the idea. And if you stayed there forever, at the end, we'll give you a pension. We want you to stay here. We think you're a quality person. In today's world, I'm not so sure. I think lots of times employees are looked at as like liabilities on a P&L sheet. That's wrong. Human beings, right? No, we were assets. They loved us. You really had to mess up to get fired at Columbia. I mean, because we took care of each other. We knew each other's talents, right? But that's how it was, to your point. And anybody could make anything happen. It was the Wild West. You know, come on, look at these, you know, Seymour Stein. I'm going to start a record company. It's going to be not typical. I'm doing this. You know, David Geffen, you know, Jack Holtzman, Elektra. Oh, check this out, man. I got a band called Love. Now I got a band called The Doors. Right. This is like, you got to remember when that starts, we're just coming, we're 60s music's just starting. I mean, you know, it's not so long ago that we're in, you know, Ricky Nelson land and that kind of stuff. And these guys are entrepreneurs, they're visionaries. I'm gonna tell you about a band called The Doors. Come on, you got to believe in it because you don't know that everybody's gonna like that. It's different, right? That's all these bands are different. So I think that was why it was such a wonderful time to be in the business because anything could happen. You know, Willie Nelson became a superstar. Willie Nelson was thought of as a country artist. People like myself helped spread the word that Willie Nelson is Willie Nelson. Forget any label you want to put on him. I put Willie Nelson on rock radio. I did a live broadcast with Willie Nelson from the Troubadour on the big rock station in Southern California, K-West. Half the DJs were rebelling against the program director at the time, who he's in my book, Jim McKeon. He's an old friend of mine. And I was like, Mac, Willie is like, he's an anomaly. He's hip. He's like, he is rock and roll. I don't even know how to describe his music. Would you put him on live on K-West? Jimmy Mac got into Willie Nelson. He goes, yeah, this guy's really good. I go, yeah, he's really good. Guess what? Live broadcast, rock radio. All of LA is like, who is this guy, Willie Nelson? He's great. Okay, but it's freewheeling then, right? Imagine being able to do that. Back in the day, it would be like, whoa, Willie's country, and this guy's this, and you can't do that. And before you know it, you know, Willie Nelson is got fans that are bigger than just country. And so it was wonderful to break new ground for people and help them see their careers through and, you know, do crazy stunts.
You've been listening to a conversation with Paul Rappaport, author of Gliders Over Hollywood, Airships, Airplay, and the Art of Rock Promotion, which is out April 15th via Jawbone Press. You can find it wherever you get books. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.